Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Shall I introduce the piece?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to The Fearer, a podcast about the overlap between comedy and horror. My name is Sarah Morgan. Hello. My guest this episode is the writer Ian Martin. You may know him from The Thick of It, Veep, Death of Stalin, and the wonderful Hartley Paul Spy, which was on Radio 4.
Oh, thanks.
Is it still on iPlayer?
No, of course it's not on iPlayer. No, mm-hmm. it was on for a month after Christmas.
Right.
And then it disappeared. Like, well, everything else disappears.
Sure, of course it does. Because there's no demand for things. Why not just... And it's like internet's finite, so why... You know, you've really got to watch that space.
I know. I loved radio. I loved doing that radio thing. It was really great. It cost peanuts. Everyone's feet. I mean, the cast were amazing. They're very sought after, and they took a nothing-y fee to do it. And you did two days recording in Maida Vale. Everybody there loves it. They're not doing it for the money. It's something really special, I think.
It was nearly as special
as podcasts. But, I mean, if there was a chain, I put podcasts right at the top.
I love the way you say podcast. Yeah.
With radio just below it, and then, you know, like Netflix, then the BBC.
And proper telly.
Yeah.
Then all proper forms of entertainment.
Then who knows what? So I'm thinking it. So, you know, think it's a neural implant or something you'd have.
Well, so I always ask my guests to bring in three fears, a fear from their childhood, their favourite scary moment from film or TV, and a fear or phobia they live with now. But before we talk about those, I just want to talk to you. I'm just really happy you're here. Hi, Ian. I'm happy you're here.
I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to be here as a person who... It really does not understand podcasts. Like now, I'm talking now,
you
right to you.
You keep acting like there's a trap's going to happen.
No,
something bad's going to happen.
It will.
Like a Japanese game show. It's going to like fall away.
The furniture is going to collapse or something. But I'm also, I don't know what the protocol is. Right now, I'm talking.
Yeah.
But am I making eye contact? Am I mostly not? Am I supposed to be doing that? Am I supposed to be talking to you like this or like this?
Have you ever done a radio interview before or anything? Like if you want to look, I'm happy to lock you dead
but
in the
eye. But it's fine not to. It's like talking in the house, but as long as you know that the eye contact is there to have, I don't have to look at you.
If it's easier to not look at me while you're talking, then
I don't know. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I literally do not know what I'm saying.
You seem quite happy to be so far outside your comfort zone.
I'm all right. I'm all right. We're going for lunch after this,
yeah,
right?
That'd be lovely. Yeah.
So that's fine. This is what you do before lunch.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fine.
If you can do an impossible thing before breakfast. Hang on, I've got that wrong, haven't I?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you can have an impossible breakfast before your first gig of the day,
a mediocre
then
podcast,
you can call yourself a man, my son.
That's it.
I think. Kipling, who once said. Whatever. Yes.
Yes. It's everything you're saying.
Great to be here. Great Big Owl, is it?
Yes. Well done.
Great Big Owl. Joel and Jason's thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's so beautiful. The way you say podcast and podcast network and Great Big Owl, it's like a hula hoop.
Well, I'm a stranger in a strange land in the world of podcasting and big owls and whatnot.
I'm so happy you trust me enough to just do this.
I do, of course. And I mean, the thing I don't get about podcasts is like, keep saying is that it's just us talking, right? This could be happening in a pub,
yes,
and we could be just talking bollocks for an hour or so,
yeah.
and then you go on the internet and listen to it all again.
Yeah,
it's like it's mental.
Yeah, but you could describe that as most good radio or most good. I don't know.
No, because most good radio is severely curated and written and edited.
That's I promise you this is edited.
All right.
I'm going to drop in some hilarious sound effect here now. So, this is edited. I will... You're confusing it with Derek and Clive.
now there's an aspiration.
It's Derek and Clive. Podcasting is Derek and Clive.
Great, gotcha.
Right.
Excellent.
It's a fanzine. It's a fan. It's sniffing
fucking
glue.
Fucking Boris Johnson. I swear to God.
Yeah, that's what a podcast is. So what are you up to at the moment? How are you?
Well, fine. I'm fine. I'm good. I'm alive, which is a plus.
Yes.
Every year is a bonus.
We are all grateful.
I'm more grateful than you,
well,
Sarah.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Yeah. I think that's fair.
And we've just wrapped on season one of Avenue 5, which is a new HBO space comedy.
Amazing. How's that been? Oh, you had a fire.
Good.
You had a fire on set.
We did, yeah. We
How
had
was
a
that?
Fire
How
just
was that?
As we were about to do... some of EP 8 and EPs 9 and 10.
Oy.
So quite a lot of EP 9 is set below decks.
Smart.
Yeah.
So did you have to do like a massive amount of rewriting?
There was some rewriting. Yeah. And you know what? It was fun. It was everyone comes alive, you know. But also it gives you the chance to, like, because you had to split them up. And so there were like two-handers. So it's just people talking to one another about... shit, you know, and somehow you can get intimate really quickly, and I don't know, it felt really good. I think it's going to be really good. I think Hugh Laurie's brilliant, you know.
Amazing. Yeah.
He does take a uniform well, I'll tell you that.
Gone quite swoony.
He does. He does. I'll show you a picture later. He's
yes, please.
Proper tasty.
Yeah. Oh, I love that he's grown into himself, hasn't he? I mean, he was always lovely, but now he's like a bit of something for the mums, isn't he?
He is, but I mean, he remains the same. I mean, you know, you're working with a comedy legend. He's not just, you know, he's a writer. He's a comedy writer.
Yeah. Does he chip in much? Or?
Yeah, he does, yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Tickle My Ring Piece, I think, was his. He has a lot of these kind of quasi-nautical phrases as the captain, you know, and I think that was one of his alts.
Oh, fantastic.
No, he's great.
I think there's a sort of, the myth around Ian Martin is that you were sort of discovered on a street corner by Amanda Iannucci chowing swear words at pigeons, and because you were the swearing consultant on the thick of it and those kind of things, and obviously... I know, and anyone who's read your longer writing knows that you're an amazing writer. And I would, tell me about how you sort of got to this point in your career up until now.
Well, I mean, you say standing on a corner shouting.
I'm joking. Yeah.
It was working week after week with my brother on a satirical
exactly.
website.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thanks, you actually, Sarah.
No, I'm saying
putting in the graft, putting in the hours week after week,
exactly.
Grinding it out. What are we doing this for? It's all pointless, is it? Let's have another drink. Why not? But it was fun. Did it with my brother, and someone sent him a link. There were like 12 people. I used to go down to the cellars, which is where we worked, and check how many people had visited, you know, the visitor numbers.
Yeah.
And it was like 12 or 15. And then Arm started subscribing to the newsletter, and he started listening. Mm. And we thought, A, this is amazing. B, it's a joke. It's not really him. But also, now he likes it. Everyone's going to like it. And it didn't. Nobody else did. It was just some randoms on the internet and him.
What was the website?
Called Martian FM.
Martian FM.
Actually, one of the things we did was this thing called Hansard Late, which is sort of a procedural thing, you know, the House of Commons. Rolling out live reports sort of thing. It's the word I'm looking for, writer, my arse. but with lots of swearing. And the speaker at the time was Michael Martin, who was this big, fat Scottish guy.
Yeah.
And there is something about Scottish that takes swearing really well, I think. It's something to do with the cadence and the swagger of the voice, you know. So, yeah, you like that. And then it was this big, it was a mythological thing. I mean, everybody wrote swears.
Exactly, yeah.
And I did more than swears, but I mean, I didn't mind. I mean, it was true to the extent that I was asked to sprinkle some sweary shit on the like first couple of eps, and it went well and so on.
Yeah.
Marzipan Dildo, that was the first one. I changed the line and said, he's fucking useless too. He's useless. He's as useless as a marzipan, fucking marzipan dildo. I can't remember now. Anyway, yeah, marzipan dildo. That was my way in.
Yeah.
My entree.
There's so many, and I won't just, like, list off your favourite. My favourite one of yours is Clitwort.
Oh, Clitwort. Yeah, you used that once or twice.
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, as a clit owner,
right?
It's so visceral.
As a clit owner.
As a clit owner, as a proud clit owner.
As a clit driver. That's auto-cruise.
It's not a body part that gets referenced very often, let alone warted. Let alone warted.
Yeah.
Bespangled with wart.
Yeah.
It's taking something nice and making it all. I mean, I love how pissed off you get with shit compounds wearing on Twitter.
Oh my God. Well, the wank puffins and everything.
Oh, and the
what
fucking cock wombles.
And dreary, bastard portmanteau fucking wankers. I hate all that shit. Shit Gibbon is just about acceptable, only because Quantic did it, as he keeps telling everybody.
Well, it's... The thing is, I think it is. If you work backwards, is there some logic to it? Shit Gibbon makes sense. Yeah, you can imagine a gibbon throwing its shit. There's a visual, or someone gibbering almost.
There's a logic. There's an internal logic. Yeah. There's no internal logic about putting spangle cunt or something.
Yeah,
which I've seen. I'm sure
really?
they think they can put an interesting sounding word with a swear word and make it something other than the sum of its parts, and it never works. Because they're arseholes.
Yes. It's
well, I'm not even joking.
I like that you didn't even waste a beautiful portmanteau word on them. It's like, no, just arseholes.
Oh, I should have called them some cum spangled fucking wank shoot.
There's almost a logic of like nice thing and bad thing, like clitwort or marzipan dildo, or you know. But it's not that. It's the visual picture.
Yeah, what's a wank puffin? Mm. There's no internal logic at all to that portmanteau word whatsoever.
No,
a wank puffin is a puffin used for to wank. I mean, it's. I'm sorry to sound so harsh.
No, I think
but these fuckers ought to be hunted down
gassed
badgers.
Like wank badgers.
Like, shut up!
Like cunt badgers.
Badgers. No, that's even worse.
Legend.
That's properly reaching for it.
Oh, is that Avenue 5?
Yeah, it's an Avenue 5.
You got some Avenue 5 swag.
I've got some rap swag.
Yes,
very nice. I've got my Avenue 5 reusable coffee cup. Oh, my Avenue 5 T-shirt.
Amazing.
I am aghast.
You're fully embedded. And you're like, you wrote an article in 2016 talking about being what an amazing writer you are, not just at coming up with like swear words, but actual
sentences. I can write.
You can string a sentence together.
I can join sentences to exist together in longer formats.
You know your way around a word or two, don't you, love? Yeah.
Yeah.
The one where
I was going, yeah, fuck you, I'm still alive.
The 2016 article, I think it is just called Fuck You, I'm Still Alive. No, hang on. It's called, 2016 was jinxed by karmic voodoo, but I never thought I'd live to see it. And it was a piece in The Guardian, and the gist of it was you were not healthy and you were not expecting to see in that year.
I got cancer and in answer to the obvious question, which was in 2006, the consultant said between 3 months and 10 years. So the worst case scenario was that I'd be dead by Christmas in 2006, which would have been a shame because the time since then has been brilliantly productive.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have done half the things. Well, I was reading something by Updike, who's talking about how we wake up each morning as a new person, and the person we were yesterday was dead. So it's all this kind of just shedding your past self as ancestors. Wow, I've actually gone podcast too early. I've podcasted too early. I'm like,
you cast your pods.
I've cast my pods too early. I've got all serious. You know, it's a light and breezy, light and breezy.
No, that's the opposite. Hot and heavy
and solemn.
Heavy and static.
Heavy
and muggy.
Yeah, heavy.
If you could go heavy and muggy as much as possible.
Okay. I mean, I'm an old man. I'm 66 now, and I love getting old. And really, that's all you can say.
What's the alternative? Yeah,
exactly.
But you wrote this beautiful article about how 2016 for most people was a terrible year because of things like David Bowie and Prince dying and Victoria Wood dying and
referendum.
Referendum and Trump.
Yeah. And it was a pretty shit year all round.
It was a pretty shit year. How do you feel now, having 2019,
when things have been... I'm really glad I didn't die in 2016.
Oh, God, no, yeah. I mean,
and also in 2017. And I and I remained alive in 2018. And here we are, nearly three quarters of the way through 2019, changed. And I haven't died.
I meant the news things you were referring to.
Oh, yeah,
In 2016, it felt like things couldn't possibly get any worse. And
I have to disagree. I think 2016 showed us just how shit things might get. Right. I think that was the fear, if you're talking about fears.
I'm talking about fears.
With the fear of the future. And I think everyone has that now, now as a kind of a low-level anxiety, don't they?
I think absolutely.
Unless they're idiots.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's more like, what is your coping strategy seems to be the question to everyone, rather than like...
Fatalism, I think. Yeah. Fatalism is the coping strategy, and everyone now has it. We're resigned. I mean, I think I am now almost, I don't know, what, 80% resigned to no-deal Brexit, just because I think everyone's spent now, and everyone just fatalistically accepting that we better get this out before we don't have Brexit, because otherwise I'm going to sound really stupid, aren't I?
No, this will be out before.
Perfect. Yeah. or we don't crash out, which would be great also, but it doesn't alter the fear that you have now in advance of whatever it is happening. If you told me in 2016 that Donald Trump would be president and king of Israel inside 3 years, I would have laughed you out of the fucking room. I mean, the reality is just has gone rogue.
Yeah. It's a really, really fascinating article because I love your response to all this stuff is a slight sort of sense of guilty embarrassment that you're so fucking happy when you wrote it, that there's a picture of you at the Emmys collecting your Emmy for Veep. There's a picture of you with your grandkids. And at the end, you're slightly sort of embarrassed going like, oh, I need to check my privilege, and it's massive, but I'm really happy at the moment. As if happiness is something we're supposed to not be allowed to have at this stage in history. Well, but actually, it's probably the most important thing.
Well, you know what it's like. I mean, we're both working at the moment, and a lot of people aren't, and a lot of people are suffering from this appalling government and austerity and all the rest of it. And you do feel grateful that you're A, alive, and B,
of course,
solvent.
Yeah.
You know, it's a massive thing.
Yeah, but weirdly, being in, do you get this feeling like, you know, we both work in sort of satirical fields a lot. I can't do it anymore. I can't do the giggling into the sea thing. I feel too guilty. I feel like it's the Peter Cook line, isn't it? That, you know, satire is sending us giggling into the sea. And that's how it feels at the moment. Like if I write a joke about someone's hairdo, am I you know, enabling or normalising an actual fucking...
I don't know. No. I mean, every 6 months, a new person at The Guardian emails me to say, "Hi, Ian, I know you. I've just been appointed, you know, and I just had this idea, do you think satire's dead?"
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, and it's that all the time. And actually once I said, "No, I don't think satire's dead, but what might be dead is people commissioning pieces that say, that ask the question, is satire dead?" And there was this half-beat, and she said, is that a thing? Would you write something?
Amazing.
And I said, do you want me to write a piece that asks the question, are pieces like the one you're about to read about the end of satire... Is that means it's the end of satire because of this piece talking about the end of satire? It's just all disappearing up its arse.
Oh, yeah.
In a complete separate reality to actual but stuff.
That's what I mean. The actual separation from actual real life. Like, that's what satire is now. It's not, I mean, satire's not dead. Satire's, like, booming. Go on Twitter. It's, like, 600 fucking lol one-liners about Boris Johnson's haircut or Donald Trump said a funny thing or done a misspelling
or
something.
Well, this is a problem because that's not satire. Well, I think the idea that you say, oh, he's just a bin bag of giblets with a Brian Jones wig on or whatever,
I felt the disdain in your voice going, of course I can write these. I just choose not to. That's how I feel.
No, I just think, you know, oh my God, look, the caging children in America.
Yeah.
What I'm going to do is give a double teapot to ICE on Twitter. And you get a sense that, oh, that's done.
Yeah.
No, and that's I'll tell you what the turning point was. I remember discussing this remotely with Kath Viner, the editor of The Guardian, about the drowned boy on the on the beach, which was such an unseeable picture, yet was on the front pages of newspapers. I felt wildly against that because you're not going to get anything worse than that, really, I don't think.
That's the thing. How numb do we have to get to stuff?
I think we're all kind of social media has brutalized us all.
My mate bought a toaster. We go through celebrities' Amazon purchase histories so you don't have to. Keep calm and love Dom Jolly novelty keyring and fridge magnets.
Yeah, I love that.
The G spot.
The good vibrations, guys.
Green dot laser sight rifle gun scope.
I've bought that quite a lot of times, I think.
Right, okay. The sex doctor's guide to keeping it hot.
Ah, interesting.
Did another child come along 9 months later?
Yeah.
Loads of great eps up now, and new ones dropping every Monday. That's My Mate Bought a Toaster from Great Big Al.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And you said two brilliant things for your film or TV fear.
What did I say?
You said...
I know.
Well, one of them was Don't Look Now, which I'd like to come back to. But the other thing was the skeletons from Jason and the Argonauts.
I was talking about this with Arm last night. We went to a prom, like people, culture people. And I was talking about I was 10 when it came out, 63. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I went to the cinema with my Uncle Derek, probably, to see it. And it was terrifying. I mean, they were just coming out of the ground, right? You remember the bit?
The skeleton.
Fucking hell. And they're skeletons, right? They're reanimated skeletons with swords and shields and whatever. And he sort of defeats them, but then they come back again. And then something happens. You remember how it ends? I mean, the point is, they're there and they look horrible, wicked skeletons. Yeah. And once you've seen that, you never look at a skeleton the same way again, do you? It always looks malicious.
Well, the grin.
That's the thing, right? Yeah. I mean, they look wicked. They look genuinely wicked and fucking scary. And then he jumps off the cliff at the end into the sea.
Yeah.
And then in the script, that's, you know, that end of scene, right?
Yeah, he swims away.
Well, what happens to the skeletons? They don't drown, do they? They've just come out of the fucking earth, right? So now they're not dead, are they? Because they can't drown. They've got fucking lungs or anything. They're just bones holding swords, grinning. They're in the sea somewhere.
So now they're still under the sea?
Yeah.
And they're just waiting for you.
Margate or somewhere, or Hastings, you know. You'll be out for a paddle. You'll be out for a paddle one day, and fucking thing comes at you with a sword.
A bunch of claymation skeletons come at you. Yeah, I mean, the logic of stuff like that. When there's a monster logic problem, it can absolutely.
Yeah.
It was the same with Game of Thrones. There was a whole thing in Game of Thrones that they couldn't traverse water. The monsters we've been. Do you watch Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
There was a whole thing that they couldn't. So why didn't they all just go to an island for a bit? Why didn't the people who come from islands stay there? Why did they all get big ships and do stuff?
Don't start picking at the.
I know, because you become like an internet nerd.
I'm saying is, I mean, now I'm detaching the non-logic of the plot and the absurdity of the scene. Yeah. It's just the spectacle. When you're 10, it doesn't matter what happens to them. You know that the hero is going to be all right in the end.
Yeah.
They just look terrifying.
Yeah. And how are you around skeletons and that kind of thing?
I mean, I don't, you know, if I go into a lab with a white coat on, which I do, obviously, you know, not that often these days. And there's a human skeleton.
That was a weird question that was.
If I see a skeleton and there's no one around, I will punch it. But what's the point?
I'm going to see what happens.
They're going to fear anything, are they?
So what were you like as a 10-year-old? You were, you know, did you see this at the cinema?
Obnoxious. Yeah, I think I did.
Yeah. Can you remember how you felt afterwards?
Probably great. If it was with Uncle Derek, I probably felt really great because he would have, you know, give me a fag or something. We would have had a smoke and gone to a pub or something.
In 1963. It's a different time.
I know. It was a different time, I'm trying to remember if I've seen it with my grandchildren.
Yeah.
Because I've seen it with my children, I'm not sure. I think it would be much, much too scary for Iris, my granddaughter.
Yeah.
But my 9-year-old grandson would probably love it, wouldn't he? Perhaps he's seen it with his dad. He watches all that stuff.
It's interesting because we're so... Because the visual effect is the I'm going to say claymation. I don't know. It's not claymation. And please don't write in nerds because I don't care. Now, if you made it with CGI, it would just look a bit shit. Well, in fact, we saw Pirates of the Caribbean had a lot of...
Did it? I've never seen a single Pirates of the Caribbean.
I mean, they're fine. I mean, for a film based on a fairground ride.
But they're still scary, right? Skeletons?
Yeah, I mean... But
they're baddies, right?
I think it's the CGI-ness of it, everything. Right. CGI monsters always feel so safe to me. So seeing something that's clearly a computer, you think there's nothing's out of control with it. It's not going to suddenly break the fourth wall or spiral into madness. It's always going to be someone clicking a mouse and... doing that, no matter how realistic it gets. Then that might be my eyes as a person of my age.
Well, that thing you touched on about breaking the wall and having this whole reality tilted reminds me of. Can I talk about the TV
Absolutely.
Thing?
Absolutely. Let's.
There was this TV thing, and I have hunted it down without success. I don't know what the fuck it was. But it haunts me to this day. It was like a public information film, and the message was clearly, don't put X in, you know, don't leave your bins out in the road, or don't put your tripe in the gutter, or your coal in the bath, or whatever it was. And it was like a dinner party, sort of. I don't know, like just it wasn't a dinner party. I mean, it was four adults around a table, and they'd finished eating, people were smoking, and the hostess started scraping the plates into the sideboard, and. She was carrying on talking, and it absolutely terrified me because there was the human adult world you'd learn to trust and believe was going to be conducted in some kind of logical. And then it was just a terrifying normalcy of it, you know. She was just doing it as, and it absolutely fucking killed me. I'm trying to track it down.
Yeah, I've honestly, when you sent this to me, I have sent out to a few people who might. Be able to help because I was fascinated. You wrote this beautiful description of it that scared the shit out of me, and I've never seen it. I don't know what it's for, and it just sounds. I can absolutely envisage the watching that as a kid and going,
horrible.
This completely normal, thing is happening, and
but it's wrong and it's mad, and they're somehow accommodating it.
Yeah.
In their lives, and it's not mad behaviour, but it is demonstrably mad.
Yeah,
it really frightened me.
Yeah, I'm good. Well, if anyone is listening and knows what this might be for, we would love to know.
I would love to know what it was. It would be something really stupid, wouldn't it? Like, don't forget your car tax, or, you know, don't smoke in bed. I mean, that was an easy one, wasn't it? Don't smoke in bed.
It was. That's the thing about all public information films, and they come up a lot on this show, because I think they absolutely tap into something. As a child, being made to feel guilty for something you didn't realise was a problem. Mm. I mean, Jason Hazley, when he was on, had this. It was absolutely terrified of an advert for. It was for grain. Grain silos.
Oh, yeah.
And it had a doll, a child's doll, being dropped into a grain silo and being crushed and mangled like a doll. He was a child. Yeah. He's never operated a grain silo. Yeah. It's not ever something that's going to affect him. The terror of getting in trouble for that.
And it's something. It is something to do with public information films. And it wasn't just in the 60s and 70s. Mm. I remember when our kids were growing up, so they were 79, 81 they were born, so it's in the 80s. And we all watched EastEnders as a family. You know, it was a thing we did. And then they started putting those AIDS adverts on.
Don't die of ignorance.
It was that kind of, you know, end of the world voice going, you know, there is a terrible disease stalking the world, coming for us. Or, you know, it was genuinely terrifying. You didn't want that just before EastEnders. Thanks. But they were absolutely terrified.
To be fair, I was prime age for those adverts. I was your kid's age watching EastEnders, and I did never fucked without a condom, and I never tried heroin, and I never did any of the things ever. That it runs through me like a stick of rock. Right. Don't get AIDS.
Yeah.
And if I
whatever you do,
I am a good girl, like, because I was eight then, so it went in. It went in at the age it should have done, and now it's like
it was so rushed that whole age thing was so rushed that people that had in workplaces were shown charts that basically. I remember talking to a secretary I was working in an architectural magazine, and she was blaming the gays because there was a line going from gays to dead babies on this chart at work, and it really fucked the whole gay movement, gay liberation movement.
Absolutely. It was the gay plague, wasn't it? Yeah. It was all wrapped up with Section 28, and when there were people protesting about that, there was the police wearing yellow rubber gloves because they thought they were going to... whether they thought they were going to catch AIDS off the gay protesters, or whether they wanted to imply that there was something infectious about the gay protest.
Also, there was that, you know, it was perfectly normal. It seems incredible now. It's perfectly normal for the head of Yorkshire Constabulary or whatever, you know, the top cop in Yorkshire saying, you know, this is God's punishment.
Yeah.
For what the fuck?
Yeah. And it's really weird how in my lifetime that feels so old-fashioned, the idea that the age of consent wasn't equal, the idea that equal marriage wasn't
insane,
the thing.
Insane, right?
And now, that's all that stuff's coming back round again. There's slowly those rights that we thought we just normalised on that front, and now they're slowly being chipped away again. And there's, you know, coming over from America, it's really odd. As if people are desperate to find something to blame all the horrors of the world on.
Well, they can say, say, and the age of accountability is over. I mean, there are no press briefings at the White House, and if there are any, you know, he controls what comes out of his, well, he doesn't control it, but I mean, you know, he won't answer the questions he doesn't want to answer. He won't have at the press briefing the reporters that he doesn't want there and so on. And Johnson's doing the same. Everyone's doing the same now. They're just making up their own fucking rules.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Yes, there are no grown-ups. That's my fear. And there are literally, grown-ups going to come in a minute. Nope.
What? And kill the king of Israel. That's quite biblical, isn't it? I have come to slay the king of Israel in the White House.
Oh, God. Well, how do we get back to the present? Let's go back to the past where things were much less awful.
I mean, I'm not a great fan of nostalgia. I mean,
let's not be romantic at all. Yeah.
I mean, I did a thing recently about the Bob Dylan thing, 69, and spent a long time sort of, you know, remembering the smells of the time. And it's all right, that little paddle in nostalgia, but you know, things are much better for me now than they were when I was 10.
Yeah.
I think.
I loved your, when we were talking about what you were scared of as a kid, and you said that you had a, well, you said abandonment, but I think that's a generic hardwired survival brain circuit thing, right?
So I think it is, isn't it? I mean, I can't think of a child that hasn't had, you know. Yeah. I think we all have that abandonment fear, don't we? That,
absolutely.
That has no logic. Why would my mum just not come and find me? You know, why would my nan just go out the back way of the ladies?
Climb out the window.
But she was taking a long time. Mm. When I was about four, she parked me there, you know. Mm. I don't know if there's any triggered it, but I mean, no, I don't think that's not a unique sense of fear.
No, not at all. I think that's what's so interesting about it. It's so hardwired. And you said the permanent fear I had was that grown-ups could turn nasty or go mad, and they weren't really in control a lot of the time.
Yeah,
which harkens back to what we were saying.
Yeah,
that they can turn on a six, start putting dinner in the sideboard for no reason.
That, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I had, did I mention it? My granddad, my granddad, who on one hand was a great trade unionist, was a shop steward, and had worked his way up through the union. He started off at Associated Dairies, ASDA. when it was just dairies. Associated Dairies, carpenter, shop steward. On the one hand, he was that. Yeah. And on the other hand, he's a fucking racist, you know. And, you know, my nan had to wash her hands if she'd taken change from a Afro-Caribbean bus conductor. Mm. He gave me a shilling for my birthday once when I was young. And he counted out 12 pennies, and I just put them in my pocket. He said, no, you've got to take them out and count them. And in case I've cheated you, and I just remember something at the time, this is a fucking weird birthday present, you know. It's a gift, some kind of knowledge that he's giving me that everyone's a bastard and everyone will try and do me if they can.
Jesus,
so I had to count
Christ.
The 10 pennies to make sure he hadn't cheated me out of my full birthday present. But, you know, the adult world was mad.
Mm.
The only sane being in that world was Tommy, the milkman's horse. He was reliable. I used to feed the milkman's horse Tommy.
Who was your hero growing up then? Who did you admire?
When I was like four.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Who did you look up to?
The guy with the animal on his head. What's he called? Not Hawkeye.
Davy Crockett?
Yeah, that's the one. Yes, Davy Crockett. yeah. He was fucking cool. He had this like mink hat or something with a proper tail and everything and a gun.
Yeah.
That's it. Done. Sorted,
that's
right?
That's it. That's all you want.
That's all you want, yeah.
Is that still an aspiration?
Not really. Not really. I mean, I do wear a hat occasionally in the winter, but it's not like, you know, it's not an animal and I don't really like guns.
Who's your hero now? Who did you look up to? Who's going to save us?
Hero now? Oh, my God. I don't know. I quite like the stubbornness of Dennis Skinner, but he's going to be dead soon, so that's not... But, yeah, okay. No, isn't that the prime criterion for hero? Heroes have to be dead, I think.
Is it?
I think so, yeah. The whole point about being a hero is that they have to be dead. So, you know, Tony Benn.
Right. Fantastic.
Tony Benn, let's say he's dead. Who else is dead and good?
I don't know. I mean, I've never heard that. I thought that was saints. They have to be dead and done 2 miracles.
Well, obviously, saints have to be dead because they have to be consecrated or whatever by the sprinkling of the thing. But, but no, heroes have to die, I think.
Right.
Not sure if they have to die in the cause for which they're heroically striving, or when they just die in their bed and had done brilliant things.
Yeah.
I think you'll find, Sarah, that heroes have to be dead.
Sure,
When we look this up on the internet...
I'll take your word for it.
Well, we'll find out. Yeah,
We'll do your last thing, if that's all right.
My what thing?
Your last choice, your wild card fear, your fear you live with now.
Again?
Which I loved when you said this to me. You said, has anyone done this before? And I was like, no one's done this before.
But it's not, on the one hand, it's not a big thing because I think everyone has, it's nothing, okay? It's a fear of nothing. Not just nothing, but nothingness. And it's the idea that all life, all this, everything, all creation really is an act of defiance against the void, against nothing. Mm. Everything in space is a kind of thing that's willed into existence. And it's all tangled up with faith and everything. But there's I haven't got it now. I wrote it down somewhere. Did you?
Yeah, do you want it?
Yeah. Is it the thing? No, is that the John thing?
John's Gospel, yeah.
Yeah, you read it. Cause
okay. I've got such a lovely speaking voice.
Well, you're doing the podcast.
Yeah, I'm doing the podcast.
You're hosting
in the first
the
bit
podcast.
Of John, one of the most, this is what you said to me.
Right.
And I think this is actually beautiful, and I'm going to read that. Well, obviously, being you, started it like some actual fucking twerp. I did a course in New Testament Greek in my late 40s.
Oh, I did as well.
We did the first bit of John, one of the most poetic and mystical bits of the Bible, certainly in the King James Version anyway. John's Gospel starts, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not."
You see, the darkness not comprehending this light is basically the thing. I mean, everybody says, you know, religion or faith is a way of defending yourself against that darkness. So if there's nothing, you know, if nothing you die and that's it, you're mulch. And all this is just you know, some existential experience, and that there is nothing out there, all that stuff. And I accept that faith, to a certain extent, is a comfort and a kind of barricade against that nothingness, you know. But it's the nothingness itself that scares me.
Yeah,
I was doing quite a lot of acid in the early 70s. With the worst person possible, which is my best mate at the time, who was a poet and a bit of a lunatic. And he would just say things when we were tripping balls, you know. And he said, "The thing you have to remember, Ian, is that there's nothing to be afraid of."
Jesus.
Nothing.
Christ. Oh, nothing to be
Don't
afraid
be
of.
Be afraid of nothing. And in a general ambient sense, you know, I'm afraid of nothing. But in that particular moment, the terrifying moment that seemed to last for about 16 years, that was
quite
terrifying.
I'm afraid of nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's nothing to be afraid of. There is always that to be afraid of.
Yeah. It's the idea of the kind of... it's interesting that you said that faith is a comfort.
Yeah.
I think the idea that there's something we don't know about, or I don't know about, is so comforting at the moment in particular, that someone's going to go, "Oh, actually, scientists are doing this whole thing you didn't know about. It's with kelp, and it means everything's going to be fine." You're like, okay, great.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
I didn't know. Oh, okay.
Yeah, they just desalinated the Atlantic Ocean. Yeah. We're all right.
Yeah. Yeah. There'll be some left hand that I'm way too thick to know about, that someone will just go, "Oh, no, we fixed it all now.
Yeah.
We've got the..."
Yeah, the iceberg's melted.
Yeah.
And there's the switch. There's the secret switch that we didn't notice in level one.
Yeah, exactly.
John Updike, who's I love John Updike, and who was a writer, and he says, "Each day we wake slightly altered, and the person we were yesterday is dead. So why, one could say, be afraid of death when death comes all the time?" And he's talking about how if each day is a new self, then all the previous selves are like ancestors of yourself, and you know, it happens to everyone, so just, you know, suck it up. But he mentioned something about writing, which I thought you'd be interested in.
Mm.
He says, "Writing is an addiction, an illusory release, a presumptuous taming of reality, a way of expressing lightly the unbearable. That we age and leave behind this litter of dead, unrecoverable selves is both unbearable and the commonest thing in the world. It happens to everybody. In the morning light, one can write breezily without slight acceleration of one's pulse about what one cannot contemplate in the dark without turning in panic to God. In the dark, one truly feels that immense sliding, that turning of the vast earth into darkness and eternal cold, taking with it all the furniture and scenery and the bright distractions and warm touches of our lives. Even the barest earthly facts are unbearably heavy, weighted as they are with our personal death. Writing, in making the world light, in codifying, distorting, prettifying, verbalizing it, approaches blasphemy."
I love that. Yeah, I love the idea that it's blasphemy.
Yeah.
That writing makes things lighter and therefore...
And illusory and
Because the things that you write on, and I think the thing, what they do so beautifully is they take the darkness, Stalin, politics, these things, and you very cleverly find a way of making them lighter without in any way taking the horror of the thing you're talking
about.
And it's with language and it's with storytelling.
It's not it's not just a physical act of writing, it's the act it's the act of imagining a scene. For example, in The Death of Stalin, there was a scene I wrote in which the clearly lovely stammering guy who gives Beria the news and he said, I'll see you later. And we see him later being led away. Well, there was a scene in which he was tortured and horribly and with references to his family and so on. And it was genuinely horrible to write because you had to imagine it and imagine what the person behind the torture was doing. So, and we cut it. We cut a lot of the heavy stuff from the film and it made it better. It was much lighter on its feet, I thought. But it's still in my head.
Is that harder, actually, once you've gone through the process of writing that and knowing it wasn't even part of it?
No, I mean, no. Because
is that writing for you? The process?
Yeah. I mean, I say it's still in my head. I mean, I dumped it. I dumped the scene more or less as written.
Right.
A little bit worse, actually, in a screenplay for something else.
Oh, interesting.
So sort of got rid of it, but I've still it's ghost of the horror in my head. And it's not just people think of writers as people who just sit and tap at keys on a machine, and it's not that, is it?
No, the thing is, if you are, it's the constant moment of it being a job and it being who you are. And there are people who are writers who isn't their job. And there's people who are jobbing writers who aren't driving themselves slowly mad in the same way that a lot of us are.
Yeah, but it's up here. I mean, it's up here. I'm indicating my brain.
Yes.
It's up here. Where it all happens, where the magic and the tragedy and the horror happen, the blasphemy happen. Mm. Yeah.
Yes.
It pisses me off. Just write a book. Okay. Just sit down and write a book, like Shining, isn't it? You just write it. Just write it. Fuck off. He had a point with the axe, I thought,
You dare question my
calling as a writer.
Tightwriter was so fucking noisy.
Yeah.
But also, did we not, in a way, we're all looking for that kind of like beautiful writer's retreat up in the mountains to go and write our novel in. And as soon as we go there, you realise you've taken yourself on holiday.
I don't like that. I don't like that thing. I like, sometimes it's nice to go somewhere quiet we're having a weekend away, the missus and I, this coming weekend, and I've said I'm not going to work, I'm not going to do any writing, and that's slightly terrifying. But I'm just going to read a book. I'm going to read a book and sit in the sun. Is it?
Because it's
sitting in the sun. Is that writing? Writing?
Yeah, it's stoking. Right. Everything is stoking the boiler, isn't it?
Tell me more about your mental preparation for writing. You wake up, there's the abyss.
Yeah, have a stare in it.
Have a stare in the abyss. Big wee.
Listen to Work Bitch by Britney Spears.
Someone else mentioned that the other day.
That was what I was... Yeah,
was it you?
It was someone on a thread we were on, and I must find them and credit them because that was the funny... Like, there was someone did a thread that was like, how do you start your writing day? And everyone was like, oh, chamomile tea and a walk, and I feed the ducks and I do yoga and...
It might be Helen Lewis or Sarah Dighton.
I might have to look it up.
Yeah.
But someone said they listened to Britney Spears' Work Bitch, and I'm like, I'm now doing that from now on.
Yeah.
It just feels. I think mostly my work day starts with clearing the decks for all the other people I write for. I'm probably not going to keep this in the podcast now. Trying to avoid the thing I know I should be writing, which is the the thing that will be the thing that makes my career really good and be personal and meaningful and all that stuff, because there's just too much. It's too much. What's your writing process, Ian Martin?
Well, it depends. My favourite thing to do in all the world, my absolute favourite thing to do, is alting sides. Sides are the...
Alts the best.
Oh, my God. Oh. Sides, listeners, are the bits of the script issued to actors on the day. So it's basically what you shoot on the day. But you get the sides maybe 1-2 days in advance, and then what you do is you get up at, like, 4:30 in the morning... in the dark.
This is if you're working for Americans, I presume.
Well, no.
This is just your process.
I'm going to be doing that on back shortly, just doing alting sides. Yeah. And I do the same thing, because then you finish by 9, 10, or you finish before 12, and you've done a day's work by mid-morning. There's nothing like that feeling. Also, I was talking about this last night. I mean, the thing about alts is, because you've got, it's not a linear thing, because they're shooting disparate scenes that are separated from one another, each scene is kind of revealed just in isolation, and sometimes you can see an angle that you might not have seen before. I love all that.
But also, it's the work. Someone's already done the work. All you're doing
absolutely.
Is making it better.
Absolutely.
And also, there's a list. You've got like 10 jokes, 20 jokes to make better.
Yeah.
So already the joke was fine because there's no panic. There's no blank page panic. And then it's fine. And then once you've got to the list at the end of 20 jokes and you're pretty certain you've done your job, you've finished writing.
Yeah.
It's the never knowing when you finish writing is the horror.
I agree. So and alting sides is the perfect thing. Because you're right. It is great for America because then you can get up almost at a normal time. Although I do like getting up early and working, but you can get up at a normal time, and if they're in LA, if you file by 2 p.m., right? It's the start of the day, so, I love that. I love all that. I used to do that with Veep. I love all that.
And do you work differently when it comes to the kind of work that's like your name, your project?
Yeah, I do what you do. I do what we all do, which is to sort of think about it, convince myself that the thinking about it is actually writing, convince myself... Sarah, that the going for a walk and retreating to the woods or having a coffee or having a bath or sleeping is somehow contributing to the thing until it's too late to do anything else and just write the fucker and just hope it's okay.
Yeah.
Really.
Do you like writing?
I love it. I mean, I don't know. I think I would go mad if I didn't write.
Yeah.
I'm rewriting that John thing. I'm rewriting the whole...
Yes, tell me about this. You said you're rewriting
the
Bible.
You know, you're talking about the thing you want to do. And, the thing that I want to do that's at the back of my head is to write something called The Pension Book or something like that, which is just, okay, this is me saying goodbye and, you know, these are the things I've learned.
Yeah.
And it's rather sort of, you know... in a rather haughty, sort of condescending, patronising way, you know. And I just think there's so many parallels between the shit that Dawkins says and the shit that the Pope says.
Yes.
There's just so many things. They're actually saying the same things a lot of time. And when I was doing that wanky course in New Testament Greek, it was great because you understood the way what they're writing about. They're writing about Jesus, who was this kind of scouser. He came from Nazareth, and he was like this... Oh, don't you don't want to trust him? He's a scouser, you know. And he's going, oh, yeah, well, I'll tell you something else, you fucking whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And
David Thewlison, naked.
Yeah. 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 That's him, yeah. Except not mad, except not, you know.
Intense.
I'm sure Jesus was quite, you wouldn't want to get cornered by him at a party, but he wasn't mad, was he?
But I mean, he says makes perfect
but
sense.
But Dawkins got me into. I mean, I loved all that early Dawkins stuff, all the evolutionary stuff. But he called his books things like "River Out of Eden" and so on. He couldn't leave it alone. He had to pick at it, and he kind of dared me. Really, he dared me to believe in God because he said, "If you believe in evolutionary biology, you cannot possibly believe in God." Mm. Oh, really? And he said, and he was going through okay, look, I know he probably won't make it to the podcast because he's just me going off on one, but...
This will absolutely make it to the podcast.
It won't. readers, it didn't. there are two set rules for life. The idea is that living organisms drive is to preserve and pass on its DNA. There are two rules. One is that all the molecules in section A have to agree that there's a common mission. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're all off doing different things. So I have to understand that they're all in it together and they're doing the same thing. And the all in it together is the second rule. So they have to get on with their neighbours. So the molecules have to cooperate and the molecules have to know what they're doing. That's exactly the same as saying, you know, there is a God and love thy neighbour as thyself, right? So, yeah. I mean, yeah, fuck you, Dawkins. Fuck you, Dawkins, because my grandchild who has Down syndrome wouldn't be here if you had a fucking say. If you discover a child in the womb with Down syndrome, it is your duty to terminate it, you said.
Jesus.
Because
Christ.
Of the burden on society. Well, fuck you, because God has other ideas, I think.
Yeah, that's some...
My God, anyway.
Yeah, well, that's some fucking... Jesus, that's a disgusting moment in the Dawkins canon.
I hate him. I mean, I don't mind. I like him when he's funny. That's the thing. It's like artists. I like Tracy Emin. She was good when she was funny. And then when she stopped being funny, she was boring. Same with Damien Hirst and all the rest of them.
Yes.
And he was funny, and then he wasn't.
Money seems to be a really good way of losing your sense of humour.
Mm.
Right.
Well, I'll let you know. Should I just read you the note I wrote to you?
Because, sure,
I mean,
not?
It might be actually...
Yeah.
It comes right after. On the other hand, I think God quite likes his being alive. Dawkins, you cunt. So,
I'll edit
what
that.
Did I say? I said, we're all here by magic, some weird one in a million shot that overrules the default state of the universe. Nothing. That's the thing I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
That the default state of this is nothing. It's the absence of something.
Yeah.
It's nothingness. I could talk about cancer and apoptosis. Now, apoptosis is interesting. See, apoptosis is what happens in autumn when leaves have gone brown and they've clearly done their job. They've sucked in the fucking sunshine and water, whatever it is. They've done their job. Now it's time to die. Everything has a time to die. And I think that's the thing about cancer, which is so arresting in a way. It's not a disease, it's a kind of script error. The thing that I was talking about earlier about the clumps of matter, the molecules, the tiny atoms of whatever the fuck it is, they have to know what they're doing. And at some point, they have to die.
Mm.
But the question these cells are asking their little regional fat controller all the time, the question is, can I die now? Can I die now? Can I die now? And at some point, the fat controller says, yes, you can die now. And it dies.
Mm.
But if something happens to the fat controller, if the fat controller loses its mind, starts scraping food into the sideboard, then all the cells say, can I die yet? Can I die yet? And they don't get any response.
Mm.
So they multiply and there's your cancer. So it's a wrong application of imprinting, of insisting on somethingness rather than nothingness. That's what I've just said. Well, I've just said that.
Yeah.
It's a script error. I've said that. It's like Euston, trains outside Euston, and there's a signal failure at Watford Junction. It's like, it all just piles up. It's cancer of trains.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely beautiful. I wish I had something profound to end on. I love that you've brought in fat controllers and the absolute the joy and the pylon of all the different references and the.
But I think this is it. In the end, life is a defiance of nothing, of nothingness. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
And comedy is the great joy for me of that defiance. You're saying, you know, I'm going to die. We're going to bust out of Europe with no deal. The King of Israel is going to start a holy war in the Middle East. The world's going. World's ablaze. The Arctic Circle is ablaze. We're losing the rainforest. Everything's shit. Everything's fucked. And somehow writing allows you to say, "I defy that. I'm going to make a stupid joke." And I think, it may be because I'm getting old and old men are allowed to do this kind of thing, but I think we'll be all right in the end. I trust us to be all right, because I think in the end, most of us are mostly lovely, and I think love will save us, and I think we'll be fine. I love us too much. I love us too. I love us and life and all this and comedy and stupid fucking about too much not to believe that it'll save. Not comedy won't save us, but comedy will cheer us up. But we'll be fine. I think we'll be fine.
Ian Martin, thank you very
You're
much.
You're more than welcome.
I'm sorry, I'm crying.
You Don't fucking try. Idiot. Yeah,
I'm
grip.
A fucking idiot.
Oh.
Thank you, Ian Martin.
Oh, can I take my headphones off now?
Yeah, of course you can. I'll turn this off.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.